we might actually see, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, it just becomes unacceptable to be eating animals. You know, why would you when you don't need, you know, you could take a single cell and, you know, produce right. the same thing. And I think if you lose a social license, we might see, you know, a ban on animal agriculture at some point, in the same way we would expect to see a ban on gasoline vehicles, you know, pretty soon.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. If you haven't signed up for the Species Unite 30-Day Vegan Challenge, you should. It is really good. It's 30 days of information, tips, recipes, articles, all things plant-based. Even if you're vegan, you should do it too because the information is great. And if you don't think you can do 30 days of plant-based living, do it for 10. It's speciesunite.com/challenge. Today's conversation is with James Arbib. Jamie is the co-founder of RethinkX, a nonprofit think tank that explores how technology will shape the future and disrupt all levels of society, including information, energy, materials, transportation, and my favorite, food. He and his co-founder, Tony Seba, are the authors of Rethinking Humanity, 5 Foundational Sector Disruptions, The Life Cycle of Civilizations, and the Coming Age of Freedom. They predict that new technologies in information, energy, transportation, food, and materials could wipe out poverty and solve climate change. Hey, Jamie, thank you so much for being here today. It is such a wonderful honor to have you on the show. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Beth. Thank you.
I would love to hear about how RethinkX started, how you and Tony met, and what was the idea behind it all?
I guess about 5 years ago now, I got invited along to a U.S. military think tank in Washington. They were looking at a scenario of a rapid energy transition. They were really asking the question, you know, what would it mean for geopolitics if we got off fossil fuels very quickly? And they invited along a bunch of experts, I think 10 of us. And most of these experts were from kind of big corporations, oil companies, you know, departments of government, big NGOs, consultancies, those kinds of things. And then I was there with this other guy, Tony Seba, who was a kind of independent, a tech entrepreneur, and he's written a number of books and he teaches as well, but he's you know, very much independent. And anyway, I remember sitting through these presentations that day, and there were literally 8 identical presentations. You know, they were looking at the adoption of solar PV and electric vehicles, and these kind of straight line forecasts out to 2040, and actually in some cases 2050, very low levels of penetration, you know, maybe 10, 20%. And Tony got up when it was his turn and he said, look, you know, that's not how disruption happens. It's not, you know, low and linear. It's always rapid and nonlinear. You know, that's a technology S curve. We get these very rapid nonlinear disruptions, and these disruptions are going to be over by the 2030s. You know, and if you're planning your geopolitics or your military strategies on the back of these low forecasts, you're going to make some horrible errors because it's going to have profound consequences. I mean, that was sort of mirrored my view entirely. And I said kind of the same thing. And I remember going for coffee with Tony afterwards. And we were like, you know, holy cow. We kind of always knew these forecasts were, you know, completely flawed based on very simplistic methodologies, but kind of hadn't realized we were planning, you know, geopolitics and our military capabilities on the back of them. And we talked for months afterwards, and we talked about every sector of the economy, everything from healthcare to food to transportation and information and so on. Our feeling, both of us at that point, was every sector of the economy is going to be disrupted in a kind of cascading process of disruption over the course of the 2020s. And it's going to have profound impacts on society. And yet we're totally blind to it. You know, people just don't see this coming. We're using these kind of flawed methodologies where we just extrapolate current trends into the future. And that's potentially disastrous. So we ended up deciding that we had no choice because no one else was providing the kind of data and the analysis required to set up on our own. So we decided to set up, you know, RethinkX. We're set up deliberately as a not-for-profit research group, not in this to make money, but we think it's, you know, it's a huge problem with mainstream analysis that we're trying to correct.
Is there a lot of pushback to what you're saying in terms of how fast this is?
Yes, there always is. I mean, our analysis is very different. We're using a completely different methodology, and our research looks very different to mainstream. I mean, typically what mainstream research does is it looks just at the data, just at the surface, you know, the sort of the outcome of these much deeper processes that drive change in the economy or a sector of the economy. In fact, in any kind of complex system, you get the same processes at work. It's really about the kind of the balance of forces, you know, feedback loops that either act to constrain change or to accelerate change. And that's really, you know, what we're looking at. But, you know, unfortunately, most mainstream analysis is a simple systems research rather than a complex systems research methodology. And so what they do is they kind of look back into the past, you know, draw a straight line to today and then extrapolate it forward into the future. That's fine when you're in a kind of equilibrium state, when you're in a period like we are in, say, or we have been in transportation. The system of transportation has been stable for about 100 years. Henry Ford recognized the system we have today. But when you come up towards one of these periods of disruption, one of those S-curves, that kind of extrapolation gets you to totally the wrong place. And so we're using a completely different methodology. And a lot of businesses don't like the research we do because it sees far greater disruption, I think, than you know they would like to see.
In your book, you're saying that everything is at the brink of disruption or has started the process. We're in a revolution already. From looking at history, you know that this is happening, and you give examples of historical analogies. Will you talk a little bit about the history first and then where we are now?
Yeah, so the same patterns of and the same processes that drive disruption in a sector of the economy, you know, also drive the events of history. It's the same process and patterns of change, you know, in terms of the progress of human civilization. We look back over, you know, 10,000 years of history, the history of human civilization, and we see over time exactly that same pattern where you get these long periods of incremental progress or incremental change, followed by these periods of very rapid change. And you can see that reflected in for instance, city size. So city size is actually a really good proxy for societal capabilities, what a society can achieve, because you need both the technology to supply that city, to produce the food and energy and the transportation to move things around and access lands and resources and so on. But you also need the organizational capabilities, you know, the ability to organize your society, to maintain stability, to incentivize people to work and actually to progress. And so we look at what we call the organizing system, and that's our ways of thinking, our ways of organizing, our political, social, economic systems and so on. And we see that they co-evolve with technology. So the two kind of work in tandem. And occasionally in history, you get this breakthrough. We saw one, for instance, with the Sumerians, where, you know, the maximum city size was a few thousand people for several thousand years after the Neolithic Revolution, after we settled down and started farming. And suddenly, you know, the largest city in the world goes from a few thousand up into the tens of thousands and then up to 100,000 within literally a couple of centuries. And so you get this very kind of rapid breakthrough. And then sadly, the Sumerian society kind of broke down. They reached their limits. They degraded their soils. They had invented irrigation. They salinated the soils and so on. And their society began to break down, and very quickly they collapsed. And then you see other cities kind of bang up against that same limit, but none of them can break through. And eventually the Romans, a few thousand years later, you know, following on from the kind of the Greeks and the Carthaginians and so on, break through and get up to a million, you know, an order of magnitude high. And you get that pattern. And then, of course, the Industrial Revolution, we get up to cities of tens of millions. So you get these sort of order of magnitude improvements. And what's interesting about that is it's always people on the edge of the old civilizations who break through because they don't have the baggage of kind of incumbent mindsets and interests that allow them to kind of think outside the box and try new things.
You're saying now that with these new technologies kind of across the board, food, energy, transportation, that what's happening now in the next 15 years even could be the end of poverty, solve the climate issue. Can you explain? Can we go through some of the sectors and talk a little bit about how this is actually happening or what's going to happen?
Certainly. Can we kind of go back a little bit, first of all, to just look at a kind of civilization again quickly? Because I just want to do a couple of things I want to add. So, you know, when we settled down to farm and we started building settlements 10,000 or so years ago, what happened was we kind of entered a new paradigm, a new system of production. You know, we moved from hunting and gathering and a kind of paradigm of survival where we were, you know, literally struggling to get by to one where we began to create the surplus. But the model of production was completely transformed. It's a model that we call an extraction-based model. We call this age of civilization the age of extraction. Because what we were doing is harnessing and exploiting scarce resources from around the world. That scarcity, that zero-sum competition, that world that we found ourselves in, drove what we call a growth imperative. Societies had to progress, or they got taken over by others. You know, it was a world of kind of exploit or be exploited, dominate or be dominated. But that extraction-based system and that growth imperative essentially means that societies, that in some ways, that sort of exploitation of the planet and of people are hardwired into the system. Because the environmental problems that you create in this problem don't occur for decades later, societies could overexploit their environment and still sort of stay alive, at least for a few decades or centuries. And so they would take over those that were living more sustainably. And the same with people. If societies tried to live, too equitably, they wouldn't incentivize enough progress. So there's a sort of balance where progress was a kind of the key imperative. And societies, they weren't aware of this, but were driven by that imperative, because if they didn't, someone else would overtake them. That's the problem we have in this system, where growth and progress are essentially in conflict with the environment and with social outcomes. And it's a zero-sum kind of game where there are trade-offs there. So they're intractable problems. We can't solve climate change without having negative impacts on prosperity and growth. And likewise, socially, we try and solve climate change, for instance, through behavior change. Then actually we end up creating poverty and worse conditions. But what we see with the new technologies that are coming through in the major sectors, in the food sector, in materials, in information, in transportation, in energy, we see a completely different model beginning to emerge. It's a model we call a model of creation, where the building blocks of that system, the resources required, are available everywhere in the world in abundance. So there is no scarcity here. Individual communities can become entirely self-sufficient. And that changes everything. It's a different paradigm, because no longer is growth and progress now in conflict with environment and social outcomes. That tension just melts away in this system, kind of like cutting the Gordian knot. It's an entirely different system. And that's really why we're optimistic about the potential. We can talk in detail, if you want, about the individual sectors and talk about how those might be disruptive.
I would like to. And I think so many people hearing this, when they're looking around and the world's in a global pandemic and on fire and melting, it almost seems crazy to many people, because we're in such a bad space right now, across the board, across the globe, right?
Oh, we can talk about the collapse cycle of civilizations, because, it's repeating now, right?
Right. Let's talk about each sector, starting with transportation.
Yeah, so I mean, what we're seeing in transportation, obviously, is, huge improvements in costs in electric vehicles. So battery costs are, coming rapidly down a cost curve, and electric vehicles are becoming, ever more affordable. And that's a first stage of this disruption, where electric vehicles replace gasoline. But that in some ways, that's just the aperitif, or however you might refer to it. The much bigger disruption comes when you combine electric vehicles with autonomous vehicles and a new business model, ride hailing, and you enable essentially robo-taxis. It's what we call transport as a service. And transport as a service is a whole different world. You have a whole different model. So you don't own a car anymore. You just access it when you need it. But what's going to really drive this disruption is the cost, because the cost of transport as a service is going to be so low that it becomes inevitable there'll be a disruption. And actually, it might even be free in certain instances. And the reason it's going to be so cheap, twofold, really. I mean, electric vehicles are far simpler than gasoline vehicles. There's just nothing to go wrong. So you have about 20 moving parts instead of 2,000 moving parts. So maintenance costs are far low. We know that fuel costs are far low. But the really interesting thing is that they last far longer. When we wrote this report back in 2017, we did a lot of research and we found electric vehicles were lasting up to about 500,000 miles. And we projected that, soon we'd get towards 1 million miles plus. And in the kind of ownership model, you'd never build a car that lasts 1 million miles. I mean, there's no point, right? We do 10,000 miles a year. It lasts you 100 years. It's insane. But when you're in a high utilization model, when the cars are being used, 100 plus thousand miles a year, it's really important. If you have a car that does 1 million miles, then you can spread the cost over that 1 million miles. Each mile travel costs 1/1,000,000th of the cost of the car. And so you get a super low cost form of transportation. If you wanted to use gasoline cars to go 1 million miles, you needed about 7 gasoline cars. So, that's the right comparison. One electric autonomous vehicle to 7 gasoline cars. It's a far lower cost of transport that you just can't get to with gasoline cars. So there's an inevitability. And because the cost's so low, we think in certain instances through advertising or through offering products, you know, we'll see transport offered essentially for free by businesses who are creating value in other ways, certainly in cities and other areas. So the value chain just gets turned on its head. Car manufacturing just becomes commoditized. You know, oil is just no longer required. I mean, the cascading effects of this disruption are enormous. It transforms, you know, everything, including our cities. We don't need any parking anymore. We're going to have huge amounts of parking space freed up. We don't need half the road space. So, you know, we'll have, you know, much greater micro mobility, you know, scooters and bikes. And that's the thing about disruption is it's not a one-for-one substitution. You know, you don't just, you know, swap an electric vehicle for a gasoline vehicle or a novel protein burger for a cow burger. Actually, everything changes in the system. We call it a phase change. As you go through that S curve, you're in a new system state. And the metrics and the business model and the value change and the knock-on consequences on every other part of society are enormous. And that's, you know, what we're going to see. And we're going to see it happen very quickly because, you know, not only is the cost much lower, the capability is obviously better, but it's better on every other parameter, right? I mean, no accidents, no environmental degradation and so on. So there are all kinds of reasons why this will happen.
What about the people who say, I'd never do that. I love my car. You know, this attachment to cars.
Yeah, people used to love their horses. I mean, we always start our presentations with you know, some quotes, you know, along those lines. I mean, you know, people love their horses until they don't, until they look sort of obsolete and outdated. And it's always the way. And, you know, it's like horse riding today. It's a kind of fun hobby that some people still do. It's pretty damn expensive. You've got to be pretty rich to indulge your horse riding hobby. But I think, you know, that'll be the same with driving. I mean, you know, you'll be able to drive in certain areas, but, you know, there won't be gas stations to fill up in, and it's going to be pretty damn expensive to get them serviced and to look after them, but you'll certainly be able to do it.
When can you see, like, 2030s, people just giving up their cars?
So we think it could happen, you know, extremely quickly. So our forecast is that by 2030, 95% of the miles traveled on American roads will be in autonomous electric vehicles in this transport as a service model. And that's because the power of these feedback loops. We think autonomy, I mean, you know, the uncertainties around the start date. I have more confidence over 2030 than I do over the start date of autonomy. We've got pilots running in certain cities now, and those will expand over time. And then suddenly we'll hit a tipping point where these things just take off. And they'll spread. They'll start in cities, and they'll start on the kind of trunk roads between cities. And pretty quickly they'll spread out. And you know, I can see a situation where, you know, a city like London, where I live, or you know, New York, overnight, they'll run pilots and overnight decide this is, you know, this will go. And actually, I think what will happen is probably a city in China or somewhere in Asia will do this first. They just clear out all the cars from the city. And it will be so abundantly clear that this new system's better that everyone will kind of race to catch up and run their own pilots and then transform. So in terms of individual cities, this could happen, you know, literally overnight once we've proven the model.
Is that kind of the rate of speed for a lot of these other sectors too?
Yeah, and they all become interlinked. So, you know, I mean, the series of disruptions we're seeing now kind of started in the information sector, right? With just huge improvements in the information sector. So, you know, we talked earlier about this kind of extraction-based model and this creation-based model. And it's kind of useful to use information to think about that because, you know, the information industries of the industrial age were kind of, you know, book publishing, newspapers, TV and radio, right? These were big, centralized, high barriers to entry, high cost type industries. Whereas the new one is much more distributed. It's kind of zero cost, zero barrier to entry. You know, zero barrier to entry. We've got billions of people communicating and exchanging information, you know, directly with each other. Totally different sort of network distributed structure compared to this kind of top down hierarchical kind of scaled structure. And part of that information disruption was the smartphone, which just kind of transformed our lives. That's what's sort of given Uber a business and all kinds of other industries being created on the back of that. And the batteries that, you know, the lithium ion batteries that we use to power those smartphones came down the cost curve until they became competitive in the vehicle market. They were cheap enough now that an electric vehicle became viable. And as electric vehicles have kind of been adopted and expanded in production, you know, the costs come down even further. We're now seeing, you know, these same batteries being used to disrupt electric power. And so this is a sort of cascading, self-reinforcing process where you know, each sector kind of disrupts the other sectors and also feeds back and kind of helps lower the cost of the underlying technologies and improve the capabilities. It's kind of catalytic in some ways. And that process is underway and it's just going to cascade you know, through the next decade. And that's why we think that every sector of the economy will be disrupted, you know, fundamentally over the next decade or so.
So they're all interlinked and they're all kind of pushing each other forward.
The reason we look at the sectors we look at are, you know, our technological capabilities or technological progress is really about, you know, an improvement in our ability to manipulate matter, energy, information. You know, those are the foundations of the physical world. And so, you know, what's happening in food and materials is just, you know, it's just fascinating. One of the key technologies in this space is what we call precision fermentation.
And which is cell-based meat, right?
Well, that's a slightly different technology. Precision fermentation is a combination of fermentation that we use to make beer and bread and so on with precision biology. So what we're doing in precision fermentation is we're taking the microbes that we find in our stomachs and in the cow's stomachs and so on, and that produces the protein within the cow's stomach. We're taking them out of the cow and putting them into a bioreactor, and we're producing complex organic molecules. So we're producing proteins and lipids, or, you know, kind of whatever we want. And it's the microbes that produce those. And we can now program microbes essentially to produce any molecule that we want. I mean, this is a technology that was developed, you know, back in the early 80s. And the first time we used this was to produce, you know, insulin. So we used to get insulin from the pancreas of a pig or a cow, and a kilogram of insulin took, you know, 50,000 animals, the pancreas from 50,000 animals. And demand was just so high, we couldn't produce enough from animals, right? There weren't enough. They were, you know, the pancreas was a byproduct of our kind of, you know, our food system, and we just didn't have enough. And so scientists developed precision fermentation to essentially produce insulin outside of the animal in a bioreactor. And back in the early 80s, you know, it cost about $1 billion to produce the first kilo. I mean, fortunately, you only needed tiny quantities of it, but it was $1 billion for the first kilo. And by 2000, the price had come down to about $1 million. And by this year, we're down well below $100. And as you come down the cost curve, as we talked about with batteries, you open up new market opportunities. So it started in healthcare, where you needed very scarce and difficult to produce molecules. And as we've gone down that cost curve, it's opened up kind of cosmetics. So we see human collagen, you know, used in cosmetics. And now we're getting into the food market. So we're seeing it already in the food market. And so, you know, as the cost comes down, you know, by about $10 per kilo, which we think we'll get to sort of 2024, 2025, sometime around mid-decade, it becomes competitive with bulk proteins, essentially. And then the costs don't stop, right? They continue to get better. There isn't really a floor here. So we think by, you know, the 2030s, it'll be a couple of dollars per kilo. So it'll be, you know, producing food in this way will be substantially cheaper than getting it from the animal. And of course, that makes sense because growing a cow is just hugely inefficient. You grow it for the meat, you've got to grow everything else. You get sort of the sort of 30-to-1 ratio of, you know, what you put in to what you get out. And these new forms of production are just much, much more efficient, far less waste, far more efficient, much less energy, much less water. And you can produce exactly what you want. And you're not really constrained in what you produce, you know, by biology, by evolution. You know, we don't have to have the things we eat today. We can produce things that are better for our bodies, better tolerated and so on. I mean, so I'm going on a bit here, but one of the things we're producing, I mean, is human breast milk to give to our babies through this way, because, you know, it's obviously for ethical reasons difficult to get in, you know, vast quantities. We feed them essentially milk proteins from other, you know, other animals. Can actually now produce something that's much better for them, much better tolerated and so on. And so on. So there are all kinds of different products that we can produce. And far better on every parameter eventually. Better, you know, better on cost, better on environmental impact, better on water use. Ultimately, when we fully understand how they work, better on our health as well.
Couple questions about that. One is, because meat's not healthy to begin with, right? So how is it healthier?
Yeah. Well, so you're right. You're competing against a pretty low bar here, right? So this is where we call the model a food as software model, because what we're doing is really decoding food, right? We're working out the molecular structures and the molecular composition, and then a sort of rearranging the molecules to mimic this. So at the moment, we're doing it on a relatively basic level, producing kind of single molecules that we're adding as an ingredient to food or producing things as a single molecule. But as we want to produce more complex foods, we'll have to understand, you know, the micronutrient makeup of these foods and all the other things that come with food, the bacteria that are healthy for us and good for us. I think it'll take a little while before we fully decode the food structure. But ultimately, you know, we should be able to design foods to personalize, to fit our own bodies, where we'll be able to essentially decode exactly what we each need. And so ultimately could be far, far healthier.
This will completely wipe out animal agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, I think initially industrial, animal agriculture, most disruptions are driven by cost and capability. That's a primary driver. And, you know, when you've got something that's 10x cheaper, you know, and better on every parameter, it's unlikely the old system survives, particularly when that old system has ugly consequences as well, right? You'll see some people, you know, as some people still listen to vinyl records and ride horses and so on, you know, I'm sure there'll be a space for kind of organic pastoral farming, animal consumption and so on and so forth. But we think over time that that'll degrade. And, you know, one of these feedback loops is what we term, you know, a social license. It's acceptable now to eat meat because there is no real alternative. When you can actually have the same thing, you know, identically, that doesn't come from an animal, you do have a viable alternative, you know, and a lower cost alternative. We might actually see, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, it just becomes unacceptable to be eating animals. You know, why would you when you don't need, you know, you could take a single cell and, you know, produce right. The same thing. And I think if you lose a social license, we might see, you know, a ban on animal agriculture at some point. In the same way, we would expect to see a ban on gasoline vehicles, you know, pretty soon.
Well, it's funny, too, how many meat eaters say to me, oh, I would never eat that. That sounds gross, the cellular meat. But those were the same people that would never eat a veggie burger, and then Beyond came around and Impossible. And now they're eating them.
I think that's how it happens. I mean, you know, consumer opinion is a kind of fickle thing, right? And I think, you know, we take surveys today of, you know, people's opinion on a kind of, you know, a cell cultured burger or on an autonomous vehicle. And not surprisingly, a lot of people say, I'd never do that. But it's just not the case. And we see that all the time. We always see these things go down that S-curve. But this is actually in some ways an easier disruption at some levels, because, you know, it's not like buying a car where you have to go the whole hog and go straight from a gasoline to electric. You know, you can do it bit by bit. You can try an Impossible Burger. You can try a Beyond Burger or whatever it is. And over time, you know, you go along your own S-curve. You might start by eating 5% of your calories that produced in this manner and gradually go along. And I think that's what will happen for most of us, that you know, we just won't see it happening. This is not really Frankenfood in the way that you know, you might think of GMOs or something. You know, what we're doing, we're taking the processes that happen inside the animal and putting them into the bioreactor.
Right. And then in the grocery store, does it look the same?
Yeah, it depends how you dress it up, right?
Right.
I think, you know. Right. We'll see a lot of resistance, I think. You're already seeing the livestock industry challenging the use of the word meat or sausage or whatever for these types of food. That's a natural pushback. And I think, of course, you're going to see that. It's part of the process of disruption. That resistance is never enough.
Are they aware that this is the end?
I don't think so. I certainly not in terms of the speed of the transition. I think, but you know, you do have a lot of people, Tyson Foods and others, who are investing in these new companies. And I think that's the way it needs to be. I don't think they're not going to set up the labs and develop these things themselves, but they're making investments. So actually, in terms of food, some of the incumbent businesses seem to be further ahead than certainly the vehicle manufacturers were with electric and autonomous vehicles. I mean, they were much later onto the bandwagon. They're now playing catch up. And that's always the case, right? We see that, you know, time and time again.
And we'll talk about some of the materials and what this means going forward.
Yeah. So we're seeing our, you know, our ability to produce, you know, all kinds of things through the same technology. So people are making bricks. People are making kind of spider silk to make, you know, fabrics and to make all kinds of other things, ropes and string. Other than the metals, we can produce most things now through biology. And I think, you know, that's going to be a massive disruptor and transform, you know, sector after sector of the economy.
What will it mean for the workers?
Well, so this is, you know, the concern we had and was one of the reasons we set up RethinkX in the first place, because what tends to happen is we just stumble into these disruptions. You know, we don't see how fast they're going to happen. And we end up having to clear up the mess afterwards, you know, the job losses, the destruction of businesses and livelihoods and whole communities, actually. And it can be, you know, it can be hugely ugly. And the jobs that are created in the new industries are often in entirely different locations. They require entirely different skills. It's just a messy process. We can absolutely, you know, see what's coming down the track. I mean, you know, when you forecast out, you're always going to be wrong, but you can at least directionally, you know, understand what's possible. And you can prepare to mitigate. There will be job losses. I mean, you can't shy away from the fact. But, you know, the correct answer, I don't think, is to protect the old industries and stop them from collapsing. It's to protect the person, right? And so I think we need to take care of people and plan for the people who are going to lose their jobs. We need to let the industries and businesses, you know, go bankrupt, but we need to protect the people. That's a challenge for society, really. By the time we get to the 2030s, it's a whole different world where, you know, once we've built out that infrastructure and we're just increasing it, you know, incrementally each year, you know, once that system's sort of fully rolled out, we think a lot of jobs will disappear. But that doesn't have to be a bad thing, because the cost of the things we need, the cost of food, the cost of energy, the cost of transport, you know, the cost of water and whatever else we need, it's going to be so cheap that, you know, concepts like a universal basic income, which we're kind of experimenting with in parts of the world, they're unaffordable today in our current context at any reasonable level. In 10, 15 years' time, it will be entirely affordable. And we talk in the report about people having a right to the things they need, you know, energy, transport, education, healthcare, and so on, because it will be so affordable. We'll have to reconceive how we think of work and rethink how we conceive of reward and incentives and so on, because it will be an entirely different world where we're no longer part of that system of production. We just have a sort of more automated system of production, and we're focused on other things.
And how does this all go wrong? Talk about if it doesn't go this way. What happens?
Yeah, there are sort of two directions that this goes. There's either this breakthrough path where we get to this world where we can live within our environmental limits, or where we solve poverty and inequality. But it doesn't have to be a kind of, you know, what you might term a kind of utopian outcome. It could be dystopian, because we might still have the technological breakthroughs and roll out this new system of production. But if we continue to manage it within parts of our old organizing system, for instance, our ownership model. If we continue to have the sort of ownership model we have now, it could be the most unequal world we've ever seen, because the information networks and the information system is going to be at the heart of everything. You know, we'll have a kind of globally networked information system connecting a bunch of kind of self-sufficient communities. And in that kind of world, you know, the people who own the information networks and the platforms that are built on them will own the world. And so it could be dystopian. But the other way it goes, which is the pattern of history and what every previous civilization has done, is breaking down, is collapsing. And that collapse cycle, you know, you can see it happening. And what happens when societies kind of break through and they expand and they grow to their limits? They get as far as they can, as far as they can reach. And that's kind of where we are now. The industrialized system sort of spread around the world. And you reach your geographic limit, and then you reach your environmental limits. And we're clearly breaching a lot of our environmental limits. And we're also getting more and more unequal. We're seeing inequality, you know, growing dramatically. So we're reaching our kind of social limits. And that just makes society much more fragile. We have buffers in the system. But you know, as you begin to reach your limits, those buffers diminish, and you become more brittle and more fragile and more exposed to shocks. And so financial crisis that you might have just, you know, bumped over in the past becomes a much more existential threat. We've seen societies in the past where, you know, they're called the horsemen of the apocalypse, where you get pandemics and drought and famine and, you know, barbarian invasion causing the
kind of where we are right now.
Kind of where we are right now. You get trapped in this vicious cycle where, you know, you try and patch up the system to keep it running and pump more money in and patch up the problem, try and solve climate change, for instance, by carbon capture and storage or carbon taxes or behavior change. I mean, what you're trying to do when you're doing that, you're patching up the old system. You're trying to make it last a bit longer. That's a sticking plaster. It's a band-aid solution. It's not a fundamental cure. And I think that's the issue, is that we do have this new system available, but we're so focused on patching up the old system. And that's on both sides of the debate. You know, on the left, we talk about kind of behavior change and redistribution. And on the right, you've got the kind of the MAGA and the kind of trickle-down economics and so on to solve inequality. Both of them are trying to solve yesterday's problem. We're trying to patch up our old industrial system and not realizing that we've got this extraordinary new system coming in. So collapse is a very real possibility. I mean, I think we're headed down that cycle unless we can kind of see where we are. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And that's why we really set up was to try and provide a different framework, a different lens through which to see the world, so we can see where we are today and where we might go. Because, you know, we think that the problems in society that we need to solve are entirely different to the ones we're trying to solve.
Yeah.
And there is light at the end of the tunnel, and there are extraordinary opportunities. We have opportunities that no previous civilization has had, the most extraordinary world, but we just don't see it. And by not seeing it, we end up in this cycle of trying to patch up this old system that's going to die anyway.
And if you had to put money on it, which way do you think we'll end up going, though? I mean, do you really think that systems will change in time?
I do.
To catch up with technology?
I do. I, you know, I'm an optimist here. I have a great belief in human ingenuity. As soon as we see what the problem is, you know, we will work out how to solve it. The problem is we don't see it yet. Right. But once we identify, I have no doubt. But, you know, we have to remember that, you know, change comes from the edge. It's not going to be America who leads this. It's not going to be China who leads this. It's not going to be Europe who leads this. It might be a small part, you know, a San Francisco or a Texas or a Singapore or an Israel or, a, you know, even a city within those states and countries. It always comes from the edge. It's people who don't have that kind of baggage of incumbency to fight against. I think we just need to get experimenting. We need to be decentralizing decision making and just experimenting with what works as these new systems emerge. But yeah, I'm hugely optimistic we get there. I think there is no other choice.
Is this how it's been throughout history, that there's a very small group of people who are really paying attention to the future and everyone else is kind of not in denial, but not really paying attention? And then the big shift happens? Or is it different?
No, I think it's different previously. I mean, what happens in history is you do get the breakthrough and then you get the collapse. Always. You don't get a breakthrough and then another breakthrough. I mean, it's because people are blind, right? So what happens is in the early stages, you have a really adaptive civilization. That's why they break through. They're rethinking everything. They're trying, and suddenly everything fits together. The last piece of the jigsaw is there, and they suddenly get these sort of, you know, runaway capabilities that allows them. This adaptability and this flexibility kind of enables you to get there. But then the essence, the elements of the organizing system, you know, whether it's sort of, you know, monarchy or just your religious beliefs or your, you know, whatever the package is that's made them break through, it becomes kind of embedded, and it becomes, you know, a few generations later, they become the fundamental truths, right? They're not, you know, they're always man-made constructs, your governing structures, but they get perceived to be kind of fundamental truths. And so you kind of think of them as a constant and they're untouchable. So that's why we end up trying to patch up the old system, because you just can't think out the box of your current system. And that's where we are now. We can't think outside the box of our kind of industrial package of democracy, free market capitalism, nation state, scientific thought, a belief in the rights of individuals that kind of underpin all those things. And of course, it's never enough. We've got this whole new system that's emerging, and that's the solution. But we can't see it in our own kind of old, obsolete mindsets. So that's kind of how it happens.
Well, I'm glad you see it. We need people who are seeing it and who are shouting about it from the rooftops in terms of change that needs to come. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. It was fun.
To learn more about Jamie and RethinkX, go to RethinkX.com. We will also have links on our website, speciesunite.com. And while you're there, go ahead and sign up for the Species Unite 30-Day Vegan Challenge. Like I said, it's really good. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you like today's episode, please do us a favor and rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps people to find the show. If you would like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. We're on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Gabriella Sibilska. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.